This is November 20th, 2011, and today I'm going to talk about the precepts. This coming Saturday, we have our annual Receiving the Precepts ceremony, this is my first Taisho since September, late September. It's been a terribly busy quarter, this fall quarter, as it always is, but maybe even more so this time. I took a trip took out yet another Sunday, in addition to the sesshins and the trustees meetings and things like that. But I think I always do a sort of overview of the precepts ceremony on the day, the morning of the ceremony. But in addition, I usually do at least one, sometimes two or three, in the weeks leading up to the ceremony. So I will today take one aspect, one part of these precepts, and talk about them. This ceremony on Saturday, receiving the precepts, is considered, aside from ordination, it is the most important ceremony in Buddhism, because in it, what we're doing is vowing to do our best to live up to what is our true nature, really. It's really about living up to our true self, being true to ourself, our true self. What we usually refer to as the precepts refers to 16 precepts, and they're in three groupings. The first are what we call the three refuges. This is where we take refuge in the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then the other groupings are more explicitly about virtuous conduct, moral behavior. The fourth, fifth, and sixth of the 16, that next grouping of three, we call the resolutions, the three general resolutions. I resolve to avoid evil, I resolve to do good, I resolve to liberate all sentient beings. And then the last 10 are what we call the 10 cardinal precepts, and these are more specific, 10 specific areas of human conduct and relationship that really reflect what is the best in us. Today, I've done at least four Taishos on these 16 precepts. That's how deeply one can get into them. But with this as the only one other than the general overview on Saturday, I'm just going to carve out the first of the 16 precepts, the first three of the 16 precepts, and the last one, because they're very intimately related. So those first three, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So in the ceremony, what we recite together is, for the first one, I take refuge in Buddha and resolve that with all beings I will understand the great way whereby the Buddha seed may forever thrive. That phrase, the Buddha seed, is a crucial one, because it acknowledges that in every single one of us, no matter how many terrible things we've done in our life, no matter how many terrible things we'll continue to do in our life, in each one of us is this seed of enlightened awareness. As I said in yesterday's workshop, the word Buddha, just the single word Buddha, not the Buddha, which refers to the historical person of Shakyamuni Buddha, but just the single word Buddha really means awakened one, another word for it is awareness, or enlightened awareness. And when we take refuge in Buddha, we're taking refuge in that Buddha seed, that enlightened awareness that we are all born with. As I said yesterday, it's sort of the inverse of the doctrine of original sin. Here it's the doctrine of original perfection. But first, that word refuge. It can be misunderstood. It can be confused with just trying to escape something, escape the world maybe, or to just sort of run for cover from the whatever one imagines it might mean, run for cover from the suffering of the world. This is not it at all. First, let's understand that there are many things in which we can take refuge. Maybe all of us need at times to take refuge in something. The question is, in what? And that's what determines whether we're bringing extra suffering on ourselves or not. So what are things that people take refuge in when they're feeling lonely or stressed or frightened? People take refuge in whether or not they think of it this way. They may take refuge in eating, overeating. They take refuge in drugs or alcohol. They may take refuge in religious beliefs, which is not what Zen is about at all. It's not about beliefs. They may take refuge in partying, or they may take refuge in whatever. And it gives a sense of comfort and relaxation. Smoking pot, surfing for pornography, a lot of unhealthy things we can take refuge in without knowing it, just out of habit. But all of these things, or none of these things, will bring us ultimate peace, ultimate happiness. What Buddhism teaches is that as long as we are seeking to rely on things of the world, such as what we just mentioned as some examples, we will be left dissatisfied. This is actually also what we call the first of the Four Noble Truths, that life is suffering, that ordinary life, when we rely on things or escapes of one kind or another, or ideas, or our beauty, our physical beauty or shape, such as it may be, or our intelligence, our wit, our family or friends, as natural it is as it is to do these things, why will we be left dissatisfied? Because they change. Everything passes. If we rely on our good looks, we're going to end up being dissatisfied when they start to deteriorate. Same with our intelligence, our memory, our friends and family and everything else, because everything passes. It sounds so bleak when you say this, but it is true. It's true. It's hard for young people to get their minds around this because the world is just blossoming for them and everything is just wonderful in certain ways. Not necessarily. It can be very painful as well. What is that old saying? Youth is wasted on the young. They don't know what lies ahead of them and what they're going to lose. So it's what we take refuge in, and what we offer in with the Dharma in Buddhism and Zen is to find to rely on that which is beyond all these things. And as soon as we give it a word, well, we risk making it into another thing. But when we say I take refuge in Buddha, it really means I place my faith in my Buddha nature. There are other kinds of Buddha. There are lots of kinds of Buddhism. There are two main streams of Buddhism. What's called the Mahayana and the Theravada. The Theravada is the early Buddhist teachings and practices, mainly of Southeast Asian countries. The Mahayana, which means great vehicle or large vehicle, the Mahayana is more of what developed in China, Tibet, Korea, Vietnam to some extent, and Japan. The difference is, in terms of differences in the understanding of the word Buddha, in Theravada, the early Buddhists, this is not Zen. Zen is part of Mahayana. In the Theravada, the emphasis is more on the Buddha, this great man who came to what we're told was supreme perfect enlightenment under the Bodhi tree 2,500 years ago in India. There is more emphasis on him as a model of enlightened wisdom and conduct. In the Mahayana, including Zen, it's more on Buddha nature. Buddha nature is what we all have in common. It's less emphasis or focus on this historical person and more on that enlightened awareness that is our nature. So our Buddha nature, our true nature. Sometimes we even say our self nature, self with a capital S. It's who we are most profoundly at the very ground of our being. Irrespective of the ways that we again and again betray this most noble dimension of our character, of our being. Nancy Wilson Ross, who's written a couple of very fine books on Buddhism, she once, in comparing the two, Theravada and Mahayana, she put it very neatly. She said, "In Theravada recognizes the humanity of the Buddha. Mahayana recognizes the Buddha nature of humanity." So the sooner one can understand Buddha as one's own nature, the more one can appreciate what this refuge is. It's placing our faith in this, our true nature, not our ego nature, not our selfish tendencies. as real as they may be, as strong as they may be, but what is beyond that, which, just to give it a word, we call our true nature, or sometimes we say our essential nature, our essential mind, our original nature, our original mind, our true self. These all point to the same illimitable nature that we all have in common. The second of the three treasures is I take refuge in Dharma. Dharma is, we try, for those of you who are new here, we try to find English equivalents for these Sanskrit and Japanese and Chinese words in the Buddhist tradition. And I think we've done that a great deal. You may find that if you were at other Zen centers, you would hear more, even more, foreign words. But some of these foreign words, it's just, you can't, they just don't make it the way these do. And these are three of them, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Dharma means, in the limited sense, Dharma means the Buddhist teaching. But in the broader sense, it means the truth. Now, I can imagine some of you thinking, okay, every religion thinks they have the truth. So why call it the truth? Well, the answer is because it is. No, hear me out. one of the most basic ways of describing this Dharma or this truth is as in terms of three characteristics. What are the three characteristics of reality? And in Buddhism, we say it's impermanence, suffering, and no self. So the first one, impermanence. Who is going to argue that there is anything permanent? I mean, some things last longer than other things. This lectern that I'm using here, that'll probably outlast me. Hopefully not, but and these platforms that we're all sitting on, they'll last longer than, let's say, a pair of eyeglasses that we may have.
You could put that on a floor.
We know that there are substances that last far longer than others. There's steel, there's iron, there's all these things. But ultimately, and we know this from science, everything is subject to decay, to deterioration. So, really, everything is impermanent. Not only, Buddhism goes much farther than saying that everything eventually is going to decay. Everything is decaying. Now, everything is change. Everything is constant change. That's not a belief system. That's the nature of things. That's reality. We don't see the change as it's happening. But this lectern in front of me doesn't seem to be changing. It's because we are deceived by the appearance of things. It looks unchanging. But we also know from science that what appears so substantial and unchanging is in fact energy in flux. The Buddha realized this through his great enlightenment 2,500 years ago. He could see that everything is change, everything is in flux, including, certainly, everything, including ourselves, our bodies and our minds. It's all flux. Everything is ephemeral, dreamlike. Doesn't appear to be. But that's because our senses are limited. When we get out the electron microscopes or the great telescopes, then we can see into the vast reaches of the limits of things. And then we find that this is true. So impermanence, the second characteristic of existence, or what we call the Dharma, is suffering. That life is suffering. We may go through periods when this is not as obvious as other times in our life. We may go through, if we're fortunate enough, we may go through long stretches of time, years, where this statement that life is suffering seems pretty remote and hard to relate to, but sooner or later we will find confirmation of this. It's not only suffering. Of course it's not. There's periods of times of great happiness, joy, wonderful things that happen to us that we experience. Maybe much of our life will be mostly happiness, goodwill and generosity and caring and sharing and so forth. But we cannot get away from suffering, because no matter how privileged a life we may lead, it will eventually end. There's impermanence. And when it ends for people close to us, there's suffering. The third one is less self-evident, the third of the characteristic of reality, which is no self. But really it also goes along with impermanence. It's the most difficult for us as Americans to buy into, because we are reared within a society that affirms and nurtures and supports the idea of an individual self that is apart from others, the individual ego self. Other societies, no other society, I really am absolutely convinced of this, having done a lot of travel and a fair amount of reading. No other country in the world so completely believes in a separate self, the individual self, as we do in this country. And so this is one that you may dispute, just based on what you believe. But when you look very closely, again, drawing from the modern science, here too, what is it that we call a self that is unchanging? What is permanent about this body-mind complex of this personality or this character that we call a self? Well, I don't want to try to sell this to anyone. I think if you practice long enough, you start to see through this illusion of a self more and more. But this is really what we call the Dharma. These are three aspects of it. And it's something that becomes more and more self-evident the longer we practice this teaching. This law. Another way to understand the Dharma is it's the law of causation. That everything has a previous cause, and everything at the same time is the cause itself of subsequent effects. That's another way to understand the Dharma. Nothing about God, nothing about believing something that seems, exotic or mystical or anything else. Causation. Science, basically. Some Einstein and some other great scientists have acknowledged that Buddhism, more than any other religion, seems to be in harmony with just the basic discoveries of science. So that's the Dharma. Taking refuge in Dharma means I place my faith. The whole phrase is, I take refuge in Dharma and resolve that with all beings I will enter deeply into the sutra treasure whereby my wisdom may grow as vast as the ocean. Enter into the sutra treasure. Sutra is the word we use from ancient India, a word for the scriptures, the Buddha's script, the purported words of the Buddha. One of those passages from one of the scriptures is where the Buddha says, things are not what they appear to be, nor are they otherwise. Things are not what they appear to be, nor are they otherwise. To say more about this law or this truth, it really means taking refuge or placing our faith in things as they are, how they are, not our projection of things, but the reality of things. The word kensho, which is the Japanese word for a first awakening experience, kensho translated means seeing things as they are. And what we find through Zen practice is that there are so many ways that we don't see things as they are, but we see things through our mental models, to use a kind of a current phrase, that we all have. And we all have certain conditioning or models, mental notions or concepts that we acquire through the course of our lives, and these determine how we see things. That we don't see things as they are until, I suppose, full enlightenment, but we see things through this prism that we, this prism of conditioning that we have built up through the way we were raised, the way we were parented, and everything about how we matured as children and then young adults. How do you see beyond the prism, the filters that we've established? That's our job in this practice. And it's where the method, the actual sitting, comes in, because sitting, by and by, we come, what we realize first is we become aware that we have these mental models that are not essential. They're not part of our essential mind. They're acquired. And then when we start to notice these things, the way that we filter reality, that's when we're on our way to seeing through them and beyond them. The Buddha said that that ignorance is the fundamental problem. He doesn't mean stupidity. He means that we ignore what is the way things are. We deny. That's another good word. We deny the way things are. It's not What we need to do is open our eyes and see things. And seeing is not believing. Beliefs are feeble compared to direct seeing. You can believe that snow is white, but seeing it is the direct truth, the direct experience. And that's always what we emphasize in Zen, is the direct experience, not believing some theology or anything else. The Buddha himself very famously said, don't believe on the basis of what your teachers or what the priests or what anyone says, but only believe that which is you see through the evidence of your own investigations into the mind. Another aspect of Dharma is when we take refuge in Dharma, we're and this gets into faith. We're placing our faith in the intrinsic intelligence of the universe. And that does take faith often. When we see, for example, when we see the earth heating up with growing, accelerating in global warming, it can be easy to fall into despair, especially if one cares about future generations, one's children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. One can really lose heart at what a denial there is of these potentially catastrophic changes. And that's good if that prompts us to get involved and to work to see what we can do in our own small way to arrest this alarming trend. That's great, but it's only half the truth. Half the truth is that the world as we know it may end someday, and we're contributing to it. The other half, and this is extremely important, the other half is that behind this alarming development, there is some intelligence, capital I intelligence. Not in Buddhism, we don't attribute it to an entity called God. Certainly, we don't attribute it to an old guy up in the sky with a white beard and who shoots down thunderbolts. But there is this ineffable underlying intelligence that we cultivate faith in as we go on. So recently, someone was lamenting to me that she's talking about her deep remorse at having put her father into a nursing home at the end of his life instead of having continued to take care of him. After his having died, she still was expressing quite painful regret about having done that. And what I reminded her of was this other side, which we just expressed, that whatever happens to us, whatever we do, that it comes out of this true mind, that it is part of the intelligence of the universe. Who's to say, let's say if he did suffer more in the nursing home than he would have at home, that's debatable, but let's say if he did suffer more, who's to say that wouldn't somehow expedite his coming into a real spiritual relationship in his next life? I know I just lost half of you by talking about a next life, but I'm going to keep going. By the way, those who don't believe in rebirth, That's fine. No one here cares whether you believe in rebirth. But just know that you're probably the minority of the world's population when you consider that in China and India, it's a very widespread normative belief that we don't live just once. That our present shape and form it passes, but then this life energy finds rebirth in another form. But anyway, that who's to say that isn't just what her father needed there at the end? It's not something we would want on anyone, especially a parent, to go through. But what do we know in the big scheme of things, whether that wasn't a way to open his mind to the three characteristics of reality: impermanence, suffering, and no self? Who's to say? Nothing we can do about it. Once we've done things for which we're regretful, or something like that, there's nothing we can do about it. It does no good to be flogging ourselves because we feel, guilty. Of course, if we mistreat people, there's something we can do about that. We can apologize to them, and that's another part of the precepts. Anyway, taking refuge in the Dharma means to place our faith in the intelligence of the universe beyond what our notions of what is right or wrong or good or bad, especially once we've done it. And then Sangha, taking refuge in the Sangha. Literally, in the early Buddhism, it meant the monks, celibate monks, the monastic order. In modern times, there are virtually no celibate monks in certainly in the West, not in Japan either. You don't have to be a so-called monk in Japan. You don't have to take vows of celibacy. Most ordained people in Japan, what we would call priests, are married in Japan. But we consider in this very lay sangha, non-monastic sangha, that is Western Buddhism, that sangha really means those who practice the Dharma, who practice the way, the Tao. And even beyond that, we can understand sangha as really anyone in any religion who is working sincerely to overcome selfishness. I think that's a good way to understand sangha in the broadest sense. Especially for overcoming selfishness in oneself means not dividing the world into those who are in the correct religion and those who are in the wrong religion. That's sangha. The Buddha emphasized the importance in practice of having a spiritual friend or spiritual friends. He probably meant by spiritual friend a teacher, but even if he didn't, say make it plural, spiritual friends means others who are walking this path with us. Others in Zen or Buddhism or Christianity or Judaism or Islam or any other religion, others who are working to overcome their basic human selfishness. We can practice alone, but we're not likely to make the progress as if we're practicing in a community. I take refuge in Sangha and in its wisdom, example, and never-failing help, and resolve to live in harmony with all sentient beings. To take these three refuges with others especially is very reinforcing. It's very strengthening, and it really helps helps one's practice. It fortifies one's practice. In Buddhist, old Buddhist texts, they have the idea that the body, we normally think of the body as just the physical body, but in Buddhism, body, there's also a kind of a shadow body that is based on our intentions. To quote an old Buddhist text, this shadow body or subtle body registers or holds intentional acts. It is derived exempt from mass, but which does not act as a support of fine and mental states, but rather functions as a sort of serial continuity or moral structure. This subtle body engenders a power action which continues reproducing itself after its initial cause has disappeared. In meditation, this subtle body derives from those elementary qualities which are not organized into a sentient being. It is not sensed. In other words, it's beyond our senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and so forth. It creates a positive or negative moral context for future actions. This is kind of a textual support for the value of doing the ceremony, of taking these 16 precepts. There is great power in placing the hands palm to palm and making a statement aloud, not just in one's mind, thinking it, but speaking it, especially with others, in the context and the container of an ancient ceremony that really supports our efforts to walk this path of non-selfishness. And then, in 1 minute or less, if we skip to the end of these 16 precepts, where I mentioned the first three, the end is the 10th cardinal precept, and that is, I resolve not to revile the three treasures, but to cherish and uphold them. And this is a matter of speech, not slandering. Buddha can mean the Buddha himself. It can mean, sometimes it's interpreted as one's teacher. Really, to lose faith in oneself, one's own Buddha nature, is a form of reviling the three treasures. It's reviling or disparaging one's own Buddha nature. Not reviling the Dharma, not reviling the Sangha. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four Bodhisattva vows.